Tonight, we bring you a 2016 Allworth International Lecture called The World Disrupted, Five Global Challenges That Will Shape Our Future, presented by Thomas Hansen, a retired U.S. State Department official and Allworth Institute diplomat in residence. Here now is Tom Hansen.
So I'll be making up these five challenges as I go along. I have the first one in mind, just because it's so much in the current flow of news right now and in the stream of consciousness of our presidential campaign. The past period, even since we saw each other last semester, has been marked by a sense of things getting a little out of control. I sense in people I speak to now in the community and also among students kind of an anxiety about where things are going. It's not just the terrorism. There's a sense that in a number of areas, not the least of which our domestic debate, things are coming a little bit off the rails. And the events of recent days have only added to that. They're adding to the populism in our campaign. And I'm not going to ignore those issues. They'll be woven into what I talk about tonight, but I thought it was useful to take a step back and look at five sort of overarching challenges, which really, I believe, are going to be shaping the future. And I will go through them one at a time here. The first challenge is what we're facing in the greater Middle East. Obviously, the upheavals that are taking place there are beginning to have strong ripple effects. It's like everything else, you know, the observer, I think it's called the Heisenberg principle, the observer affects what it's observing. And we have done a lot more than observe the Middle East in recent decades. So the situation there is evolving as a result of reciprocal trends, the way the West is impacting the Middle East and currents that are going on there. It is a situation of great frustration to this gentleman. I highly, highly recommend the current issue. I hate to, not to favor one news outlet over another, but the current issue of The Atlantic has a highly unusual document now. It is almost a testament by President Obama looking back at his presidency and the foreign policy. He's given unparalleled access to Jeffrey Goldberg, a journalist for The Atlantic, over a number of years. And it is a remarkable document, and it spells out clearly how much his intent as president has been to move the U.S. away from a focus on this greater Middle East and toward areas he believes are of greater importance to the future of our country and ultimately of the planet, and particularly Asia, but not only. And, you know, he announced a pivot toward Asia early in his presidency, but just as in F. Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby, the waves are bearing him ceaselessly back toward the Middle East. I was surprised by I'll just give one quote from this article, which I think sums up his thinking, and I'm not sure how to take it. In the context of visiting Asia, talking with young, aspiring people in Asia, full of potential, even Latin America as well, and his travels down there. Of course, he's just been in Cuba. He said, if we're not talking to them, these young, aspiring people in those regions, because the only thing we are doing is figuring out how to destroy or cordon off or control the malicious, nihilistic, violent part of humanity, then we are missing the boat. Now, what does he mean by the malicious, nihilistic, violent part of humanity? Well, a main point I want to make in this first section is this, that we are dealing in this region with the results of political upheaval, and the danger is that we conflate this with the religion of Islam as a kind of an existential threat. And we already see it happening in our campaign. As much as the Middle East itself is a challenge, this twist in our thinking is a challenge. And if we don't think it through and get beyond it in our debate, but also in our thinking, we really are going to be defeated by this challenge. I'm going to go into this set of issues now a little bit, maybe more than I should even, because I think it's so important. Obama has been critical of our invasion of Iraq. He opposed the invasion of Iraq. He's also been critical of the enthusiasm and the media enthusiasm, as you can see here, Miss Shock and Awe indeed, in which we launched into that. Now, I think pretty much everyone agrees that the effects of that invasion have been the opposite of what we intended. We removed a counterweight to Iran. We created Iran as a regional power. We ended up installing a government that is an ally of Iran. And we drove a deep wedge between the Sunni and the Shia in Iraq, which has since spread. That is a result, quite frankly, of our doing. And I think even Donald Trump has been referring to that, much to the chagrin of other Republicans. Now, as I say, the ripple effects of this are legion. Here is a scene, this is a barrel bomb being dropped on a village in Iraq. This has been happening all over the country. This is a scene in Aleppo. This is what Iraq looks like now. As one half of all Iraqis, one half of all Syrians have lost their homes. And we see the violence spreading. This is a photo from just yesterday. Spreading into the ticket areas of our busiest airports. And of course, this tragic ripple coming out of this conflict, the massive flow of immigrants risking their lives with dangerous crossings in boats like this, and causing great instability now in Europe. So this is a challenge. It is a tremendous challenge. And how we work with the countries in the region and with our own decision-making process will be key. ISIS is a radical group, numbering in the tens, high tens of thousands perhaps, spreading to other countries in small cells, with a radical ideology based on a certain interpretation of Islam, which I will describe to you in a minute. Because Islam is, in fact, I don't know what the word to use is, poignant, compelling religion. Why is it that Islam is spreading so rapidly in the world? What is it about this religion that is making it the fastest growing religion in the world? I think one reason is this. It presents itself, you know, it comes out of the Arabian desert, a kind of a simplified Spartan landscape of this kind. It presents itself as a purification and a simplification of Judaism and Christianity. It honors Abraham, Adam already, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, as prophets. In Islam, when you say the name Jesus, you say, Jesus, may his name be praised. Their idea is, though, that Muhammad brought this religion to its final form, the idea of one God. In Islam, there's a concept called shirk, which means association. You must not associate anything else with God. There is only God. Therefore, the idea of a divine Jesus or of a resurrection or any of these things, they worship Jesus, but not in that way. He's a precursor. This is the cave above Mecca where Muhammad, in the early 600s, had his visions. There was a lot of trade with the Jewish and Christian communities in the Middle East at that time coming through Arabia. And he was visited by the archangel Gabriel. who revealed to him this final distillation. And the five pillars of Islam, I think this is one reason the religion in certain countries and certain cultures takes hold. It is simple, and it is what is called an orthopraxy, an orthodoxy of practice. Christianity is very much an orthodoxy. It's an orthodoxy of doctrine. You've got to believe a lot of detail in Christian doctrine to be a real Christian. Not so in Islam. All you need to do is believe the first one. There's one God. That one God is Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. That's it. And beyond that, prayer five times a day, giving of alms to the poor, 2.5% of your income, making the pilgrimage to Mecca if you can, if you're financially and physically able, and then the Ramadan. That's it. And this is something that people can wrap their minds around. If you're in a poor village in Africa or in other parts of the world, this is something that is clear as can be. Now, the Muslims rever Jesus. They rever Abraham. They interpret them differently, but they consider them divine prophets or prophets. But within Islam is the belief that there will be a Mahdi who will return at some point to reestablish the pure caliphate of Muhammad. And different sects of Islam have different ideas of who this Mahdi will be. ISIS, the leaders of ISIS, it's pretty well documented now, have a twisted version of this. And one reason they want to develop a caliphate is there has to be a caliphate for the Mahdi to return to. And apparently some of the leaders of ISIS encountered some religious figures in jail when we jailed them in Iraq. Now, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State, was nothing if not clear-minded. And he saw everything in terms of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. Everything was determined by whether you were socialist / communist or capitalist. And if you were socialist, you were going to ally with the Soviet Union in his mind, and you were against us. It was very much a you're with us or against us mentality all through the 50s and beyond. Now, ironically, the first leaders that emerged in the Muslim world after independence were secular. The first impulse coming out of the Muslim world after World War II, Ataturk in among the Turks solidified a highly secular state, which is coming undone now. Mossadegh in Iran was elected democratically in 1953 as a secular socialist. This was unacceptable. We staged a coup, overthrew him. Nasser in Egypt, secular. And the Ba'ath Party, which took control on the left, Saddam, the first Assad pair, and then representatives from Algeria, all secular. Looking back, if only we had leaders like that now, because we actively undermined all of these. And after 9/11, of course, we favored the Mujahideen radical Islamic forces that were opposing the socialist government that the Soviets in it had imposed. And among the fighters there, of course, were Osama bin Laden and Zarqawi, who became the father first of al-Qaeda in Iraq and then later, ultimately, of ISIS. There's a direct line that comes out from them. So, as I say, 9/11 was a real watershed following the Afghan invasion. Newsweek, shock and awe, we were all into it back then. And the divide between the Sunnis and the Shia in the region really became a gulf when Jerry Bremer on the left, our proconsul in Iraq, listening to Ahmed Chalabi on the right, he's the guy who sort of was the consular to the U.S. government then, we now believe he was an Iranian agent the whole time. I'm serious. He passed away this past year. Chalabi convinced us that we should de-Ba'athify, remove Sunnis at every level of the government. The opposite of the approach we took, say, after we defeated Germany or Japan, and that gulf has never been bridged because the Shiite government has consistently pushed away and persecuted the Sunnis ever since. And briefly, we all know, here's the ethnic mix in Iraq, and that Sunni uprising in Iraq spilled over into Syria. And we are on our way toward what's happened now. Very hard to put all this back in the bottle. Here's Zarqawi, who came, was involved until we killed him in 2002. And Mr. al-Baghdadi, who now is the current leader of ISIS, we arrested him immediately after our invasion. He was a theology student. We jailed him for nearly a year, and he came out of jail having met the people he's working with now. As I say, he has an apocalyptic vision, as I described before. Now, the emergence of a more multipolar world in which regional actors now are beginning to assert their interests in a way they didn't during the Cold War. Joe Biden has said our biggest problem in the Middle East today is our allies. That's Biden's recent assessment. And Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey are all, and Russia, of course, now, are pursuing their own interests in the region. The sectarian divide that you see there between the Shiite part of the Middle East in orange and the Sunni in gray is only deepening, and we're involved now in proxy wars that are being fueled by these regional powers, frankly, without our blessing in many cases. The Saudis have created a coalition that is acting without us in Yemen. This is the new king, Mr. Bin Salman. And more important for the future is his son, Mohammed bin Salman, who, by all accounts, is beginning to call the shots. He's a very unknown and spontaneous figure. Washington cannot figure him out. And we don't really know where Saudi's going right now. They're pursuing their interest, though, which is to keep Iran from controlling Iraq, and also Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and Syria, but also to prevent elected governments in that region. The Saudis' greatest fear is an elected government like the Muslim Brotherhood that undermines their legitimacy. While this is going on, of course, we've signed a nuclear deal with Iran. It's very hard to this. I think could be Obama's biggest legacy if it does stick. But the Saudis don't like this, and the Israelis don't either. And, of course, this is Netanyahu speaking before our Congress last year. Israel is drawing closer to Saudi Arabia now in many ways. And, of course, they're facing their own problem. These metal detectors are going up all around the old city in Jerusalem to detect knives, because there have been knivings. And the peace process has broken down in the Middle East between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And when you have a sort of a blocked situation like that, the pressures bubble up. Now, these are probably the two biggest regional actors that we're dealing with out there. They have a lot in common, in a way, Putin and Erdogan. They've been close in the past, but each of them is forcefully pressing now their own interests in the Middle East. They're, in a sense, seizing initiatives. For the Turks, this is the nightmare, a Kurdish state. Here you see the Kurds all through the region. If Iraq and Syria fall apart, what happens to those Kurdish regions? And Erdogan is convinced that the West will eventually engineer a Kurdish state. This is what a Kurdistan would look like. The reason that this people have lived so long and are so well defined is they're a mountain people in a flat region. You can see these mountains are pretty much the contours of a Kurdish state. And this goes way, way back in history. Now, the Russians have acted on their own. They're starting to bomb in Syria, and they are aiding the Kurds in Syria. This is very troubling to the Turks. That is an actual photo of the Russian jet that was shot down by the Turks. And the pilot who was bailing out there was beaten to death when he got to the ground by the British forces. So, once again, our allies, and this is the first military action between a NATO country and Russia ever. Ever. And this was done without consulting NATO. So it's really a very... Erdogan is thinking big. This is his new palace, which is kind of an unprecedented place. This may be where it's heading. This could well be the result. What Russia's doing appears to be to try to lock down an Alawite state that would be under their control, or at least the close ally. Some kind of Sunni polity may come in the middle. Iran will be sure that that part, the Shiite part of Iran, will stay an ally. What happens though to the Kurds? That's the big question going forward. Now, as I say, this is really the beginning of the second point, which is this, that we're facing now regional powers asserting themselves in their own regions. So Turkey, Saudi Arabia, but most important, of course, Russia and China, which are showing more and more signs now of actively asserting themselves. This is the result of all the economic changes that have taken place. China is stronger now. Russia has come back to some extent. In 1945, we were really very much the center of things, but we are still important, but don't have the same relative weight globally that we did, and that's as it must be. The world is changing. It's ironic. When the Syria crisis broke out, the Russians say they have two threats facing them. This is in their national security documents. Number one, terrorism emanating from the Middle East. And the idea being that instability in the Middle East will cause terrorism to come to the Muslim populations of Russia. So Putin, at the beginning of the crisis, came to us, and this has been documented by Matti Ahtisaari, who is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. He was the first negotiator for the UN on Syria. And in his recently published memoirs in Finnish, they haven't been translated yet, he says, the Russians came to us and said, look, we agree Assad must go, but he has to be part of the negotiations at the outset, or else we'll have chaos. There'll be a vacuum. Ahtisaari agreed, but the U.S. said no, because we believed that he would fall within 2 months. Now, this was bad intelligence. This was wrong. And Obama, in his interview, alludes to that. This was a mistake. And in fact, once the Russians start bombing, we are now at the position Russia suggested at the beginning of the crisis. Kerry is using the same language that Putin used. We can't just dump Assad. We'd have a vacuum. He has to be part of the negotiations. We have come all the way around to the Russian position. So who's setting the agenda here? And should we have accepted this idea 200,000 deaths ago? I don't know. But it's an example. I'm citing these as an example of this new situation. Now, over in Ukraine, of course, the Russians acted forcefully when their close political ally, Yanukovych, fell by seizing Crimea and stirring up separatism in the Far East. They are, they say, open to an agreement that will give a highly federated structure to Ukraine. We are supporting to the hilt the Ukrainians. Joe Biden was in Ukraine in December. This is Mr. Yatsenyuk, Yevgeny Yatsenyuk, who is the prime minister. And Biden told the Ukrainian parliament that he had spent more time with Yatsenyuk talking to him in the past year than he had to his own wife. This was Biden, quote. And he said, this is your last chance. You have to get your act together. You've got to stop the corruption. We support you, but you've got to go part way. And unfortunately, in Ukraine right now, this is Yatsenyuk being lifted off the podium in the Rada by an opposition member. things are quite boisterous in Ukraine right now, and the corruption has not lessened. So it's a very difficult trade-off. I think in Europe there are more voices, even though the sanctions may be prolonged, calling for some kind of an understanding with Russia at some point. Now, in the midst of this, NATO expanded further. We brought Montenegro in at the end of last year. Yet another move. That's long been in the works. It's not that provocative, actually. The Russians have factored that in long since. But Ukraine, Georgia, that's where they're drawing the line. Now, one person who is beginning to sound the alarm about a growing nuclear threat is William Perry on the right, a former Secretary of Defense under Clinton. He has just come out with a book saying that both sides, the U.S. and Russia now in this period of bad relations, are moving toward a nuclear upgrades of tactical, in other words, usable nuclear weapons. And Perry is concerned that this could lead to miscalculations and even nuclear danger. This is not new. This is a photo from the 1950s during a nuclear artillery exercise in the Southwest. Members of Congress attended this demonstration. I'd like to see their health charts after this. But the idea of small-range nuclear weapons is destabilizing, and this is the new one. This is the proud scientist with the new version now that we're developing, which is very usable, very sanitized. Theoretically, you could use it in a kind of a controlled way. And Perry is saying, this is dangerous. We've got to stop thinking this way. And so in his view, we're paying too high a price right now in our relations. So multipolar world, do we stick with a country like Ukraine and its desire for democracy? Do we, as we have in Syria, tilt more toward the direction of one of these regional powers? I don't know the answer to that, but it's a challenge. It's going to be one of the challenges facing us. And not to mention in Asia. I've talked a lot about China in previous talks. I won't dwell on this, but I think that reef is very well named. Mischief Reef. And this is one of the reefs that the Chinese now, it's a before and after photo. You read about these islands now that are appearing in the South China Sea. Well, this is what they're doing. They're dredging them up. They're coming with boats full of sand and then building airstrips and installations on them. The danger of a naval confrontation with us are growing. And once again, China's view is this is our region. And we're not used to thinking that way. We're used to, okay, Japan, our other allies in Asia, depend on us to have a suzerainty in that region. And so we're caught here on the horns of a dilemma. Which way to go? All the while, China, as we've discussed previously also, is launching this Eurasia-wide New Silk Road project, which is drawing in more and more countries, including many of our allies. We've responded with a Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is frankly a negligible agreement. The only country that really is affected by it is Vietnam. It's a big deal for Vietnam because markets are opening. But as you've seen, most of the candidates now, including grudgingly Hillary, are now beginning to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership because of its impact on jobs, potentially. So once again, it's a complicated... Whereas the Chinese... thrust is going forward, as this chart shows with Pakistan. Now, this is a new kind of multipolar set of initiatives that are emerging, and we've got to figure out how to respond. Now, enough of this sort of states and geopolitics. I'm going to go on now to several very much underlying challenges. The position of women in the world today, I think, is at the heart of a lot of what's going on. In the various religions, in the way religions are evolving, in development, many studies have shown that the more empowered women are, the better the chances of developing. And in fact, in the UN and World Bank are trying to work through women now at the local level many times. But in much of the world, traditional forms, well, traditions, which we would consider to be discrimination, continue. Now, Jimmy Carter has made this a centerpiece of his activity from here. This is a book that came out. He's really sounding the call on this. And particularly on the issue, he was at Augsburg last year at the Nobel Peace Prize Forum, describing his travels, his conversations with women around the world, and the challenges they face. Primary among them, child marriage, which is practiced in many, many, many parts of the world. And I think I may have related this before, but he spoke with a group of young women in Nepal who had been trafficked into brothels and rescued. And as he spoke with them, they described what their life would have been like otherwise, which would have been to be married to a much older man at the age of as young as 9 or 10, and to find oneself subject to their will to the point of life or death, right? That actually they have that kind of sway over them. And when Carter asked them, well, that sounds extreme, which variant here would you prefer, the brothel or the traditional? And they all said the brothel, because there's a chance of escape. So here you see just a few of the countries and what percentage of young women are married as child brides. So this is defined in the UN Human Rights Charter as a human rights violation. Already in the 1950s, this practice was seen as a human rights violation. But what do you do if it's part of the traditional culture? Or to some extent, even part of the religion? Now, one of the points that Carter's making, and he left the Southern Baptist Church. After 6 decades, he broke with them a few years ago, grudgingly, because of their position on female pastors and priests. And he writes that all around the world, male political figures are interpreting religious texts in a way beneficial to them. You know, the way ISIS interprets Islam in a way that suits its interest, Jimmy Carter is saying this is going on within religions in the same way. And, of course, we see more subtle forms of this in the workplace here and in many aspects of our life here, pay levels. It's a less violent, perhaps, although in the homes, of course, you've still got domestic violence going on. Trafficking in persons is huge. What they call the TIP report, which comes out every year, issued by the U.S. government, is very interesting reading as they describe the kind of traffic. And, of course, a very large part of the human trafficking involves women for sex trafficking, child sex trafficking, forced labor, that kind of thing, very often with women bearing the brunt. It was tragic to see a photo online today of a young woman who took a selfie and sent it to her friends just before the Air Dubai plane crashed in a Russian town. Now, there are many Russian and East European prostitutes in Dubai and all through the Middle East. And this young woman, probably the way she was described, probably was that. Now, you can say that they are doing this by their own free will, but on the other hand, the structure of their lives makes this a rational choice for them. There's something structural in what they're facing back home that makes them take that step. So these issues take many forms. I agree with Jimmy Carter that it's a major challenge going ahead, especially because we're dealing with cultural differences that are hard to solve and resolve. So we've already gotten through three of these, the first one being the situation we face in the Middle East, second, this more multipolar world, women, and now, of course, this situation, which obviously, I mean, I won't be telling you much that's new here, but the whole issue of the climate sustainability is one of the challenges, and how the world community, because it's a global issue, will be able to get itself together. Now, there were a couple of very important developments that took place late last year. In Paris, they call COP21, the Paris Climate Conference took place. This is the first really big conference since Copenhagen a few years ago, which was a disaster. It just fell apart into cacophony. And many people were afraid that, Paris might be the same thing. Actually, the result was far better. The basic goal was to try to keep global warming below 2 degrees centigrade. The idea being that beyond that, we really do start to see the effects. You know, in the Q program yesterday evening, Aparna had arranged a showing of a film called Easy Like Water, an amazing documentary showing the current situation in Bangladesh, where the water is encroaching on everything, on people's lives, to the point where entrepreneurial people are devising ways to keep everything afloat. If we're going to be flooded, let's have boats that are schools, boats that are libraries, boats that will save people during floods, boats that are government. It's to that point. And already some parts of the world are beginning to feel the effects. And one reason is this, that in the southern hemisphere, in the warmer climes, a 1 to 2 centigrade increase is enough to cause what's happening, for example, in Bangladesh. And at the Paris talks, the developing world is saying, you know, your 2 degree centigrade threshold is discriminatory. It's fine for the north. It's not fine for the south. And for Minnesota, it's great, actually. I mean, we may become more like Nebraska. That's what they're predicting. No, seriously. Our climate will be a bit more like Nebraska going forward. So study their charts every day. That's where we're heading. We'll no longer be a cold Omaha. We'll be an Omaha, Omaha. So this agreement this is an interesting issue. Many people are going around saying that this is legally binding, because it's one thing to state all these goals, but how do you get people to actually do it? Well, and John Kerry has told our Congress that it's not legally binding. Well, here's how it works. The commitment in general terms to a 2 degree threshold is legally binding. None of the steps to get there are legally binding. Nothing specific is legally binding. So it's a legally binding general commitment with no legally binding steps. It has to be monitored. And there are many citizens groups, including down in the cities, forming now to try to monitor it. There'll be, in 5 years' time, a major reassessment of how countries are doing. Money's been promised to the developing world to help it to adjust to the extent possible. And it officially comes fully into force by 2020. Now, the prelude to this very potentially encouraging agreement was a bilateral deal between us and the Chinese, in which China agreed to begin to lower its carbon emissions by 2030. They say that's as soon as they can start bringing it down at all. So it's like turning an aircraft carrier. And we agreed to, I believe, a 25% reduction in our emissions by 2025. Now, the Supreme Court has just ruled that void. Our separation of powers is operating, and that provision that promise that Obama made has been challenged in court and is now blocked. And the rest of the world is watching and saying, well, no, wait a minute, we just finished this conference a few months ago, and now in the U.S. There is second guessing. So, encouraging, but it's got to be implemented. And will that happen? If not, as I say, the images we saw last night from Bangladesh are chilling. Now, at the same time, this past year, whoops. Did somebody hit the... There you go. Yeah. At the UN, they adopted the Sustainable Development Goals, what they call the SDGs. Now, this is a sort of a framing platform for the next 15 years of UN activity. The precursor to this, the Millennium Development Goals, did have some positive effects. Now, there's a difference, though. The Millennium Development Goals were 8 in number, with 17 goals built in. These are 17 in number with 169 goals. Now, these are all laudable. But as the economist said about this, something for everyone has produced too much for anyone. Everything's a priority, then nothing's a priority. And this is the problem going forward. And the gentleman on the left is being, at least among expert circles, roundly criticized. He's been seen as a weak UN Secretary General all along, Ban Ki-moon. But this is being seen as really a stain on his record as he leaves. He's finishing his second term. Now, this is an interesting map. This is something that Yale came up with late last year on the basis of pretty extensive research. Percentage of adults worried about global warming. And there you can see, if it's blue, they're really not too worried at all. And as you might expect, the concern is higher, for example, in California, where they've already had water rationing, or in Florida, where you're already seeing some coastal effects, and a little bit on the East Coast, where you've had a couple of superstorms, which have spooked people. I'm trying to figure here, looking at the Minnesota map, and that kind of dark thing in the middle, is that just Minneapolis, or is it also St. Paul? I can't tell whether it's... Maybe it's the five-county metro. I don't know. But anyway, it's interesting. And, of course, up here in Duluth and straight north of here, you've got some consciousness. And up toward Canada, higher degree. One important point, though. This same map for countries like Germany or France would be mostly red to purple. The public consciousness in countries, especially in Europe, is much higher than here. And I think Germany takes the cake, where they're in the midst of what they call the energy transformation, where at great cost and with the buy-in of their corporations, they are moving towards sustainable energy in a big way. Now, they believe that long-term they will master the technologies involved and be in a good position globally. But it takes long-term thinking to do that. There's some signs of positive development in the U.S. among our business community, though, too. Here's Michael Bloomberg and Hank Paulson, who was Secretary of Treasury in 2008. They have formed a group called Risky Business, and they are trying to convince other CEOs and corporate leaders of the importance of climate change. And in the Twin Cities, Land O'Lakes, Ecolab, Cargill are doing a lot. They all have huge sustainability departments. So for any students who are interested in these issues, I mean, there's a lot of action down in the cities on this. And this is the new group now. These guys came together at the Paris conference, and they formed a new group of 27 young billionaires called the Breakthrough Energy Coalition. It was kind of Bill Gates' idea, but Jack Ma in the middle from Alibaba, Mark Zuckerberg on the right, and Jeff Bezos are among the many young CEOs now that are on board. And they're going to pool a lot of money trying to develop new technologies. And at Paris, Bill Gates was, I think you could say, giddy. He was giddily talking about a magical solution that they felt was going to really change everything now on the climate change issue, and that their group was going to be putting a lot of money. In a nutshell, artificial photosynthesis. Plants use water and carbon in the process of photosynthesis, produce sugar and starch. This is the basis for biofuels. And as Gates pointed out, plants are extremely inefficient in the way they use the sunlight. They only use 1% of the sunlight coming at them in this process. So what if we could develop a process, artificial, that would more efficiently use sunlight and then produce massive amounts of biofuel without taking it away from agriculture. Now, is this pie in the sky? I don't know. I see that Gates gave another enthusiastic speech just last week about this. So at least for in these months, this is something that they're looking at. Is there a kind of a magical solution to this along those lines? Well, at least some of these people are beginning to focus and put some money into it, and we'll just see. Obviously, the challenge is huge. You can see here, these are the 10 most polluted cities in the U.S. and in China. And you can kind of compare. Obviously, the Chinese situation is far more dire. And our it's interesting that the most polluted cities are all in California, most of them. Not what you would have thought, necessarily. I guess Pittsburgh no longer produces as much as it used to, as our manufacturing has declined. And our press has covered the pollution in China for some years now. But this is an astonishing chart. China pales in comparison to what's happening in Delhi. And in fact, of the 20 most polluted cities in the world, 13 are in India. And Pakistan, of course, is up there, and Bangladesh. So actually, a lot of the real pollution is happening not just in China, but elsewhere. So, you know, the pollution coming out of this part of the world as it rises to have a better living standard, to live more like us, at least in terms of the commodious living, this is going to continue. Now, I'm coming to my final point now, after this Middle East Islam challenge, the multipolar challenge of countries asserting themselves regionally, the position of women, over half the world population, and all the issues of sustainability, on which there's been some movement in the past year. Human labor, homo faber, right? Man does things. What if there's no jobs? What does that mean for a society? What does that mean for the political order? Now, it's a supply and a demand thing. Demand is growing. Look at the world population. More and more people, especially in the developing world, who are going to be seeking a livelihood somehow, heading up toward 11.2 billion at latest UN estimate. This came out late 2015, so this is the most recent one. Of course, things can change, but this is the best guess. We've talked about this before. By 2100, actually many of the countries in Africa will have come up a lot. In fact, the UN estimates that by 2100, 40% of all humans will be living in Africa as they go toward 4.2 billion people. Now, this is in addition, of course, then to large populations in India and also still in China. So the role of the West, demographically, is shrinking tremendously. And especially when you look at countries like Germany and Japan, Germany last year had the lowest birth rate of all the 215 countries that were surveyed. The lowest. Japan was number 213. These were the two rising powers of the early 20th century. And they're still number 3 and 4 in the global economy. And yet, so the demand is shifting, and large youth populations are going to be demanding work. And now here they come. These little robotic pets are already all over Japan in hospitals and in, you know, sort of assisted living. They're coming here. They're already out and about in our economy. They're very cuddly and very cute. They're robots. Japanese are moving forward in leaps and bounds with humanoid robotics. They have girl groups now where the lead singer is a robot and is programmed to do all the dance moves that the rest of the human group does as they sing. And as we all read recently, DeepMind, AlphaGo, it's called, a computer system. You know, I've played Go, and it's a very interesting game because it's counterintuitive. You've got to kind of psych out your opponent. You have to kind of understand the psychology of your opponent. It's a very counterintuitive game. And a lot of people thought a computer would never be able to beat a human because that would imply that a computer could have the ability to scope us out. Well, as you read a week or two ago, AlphaGo beat the reigning world champion in Go. The impact of robotics and artificial intelligence on human labor is, I believe, going to be one of the deepest challenges facing us going forward. This book came out last year. It was the Financial Times Book of the Year, and it was the centerpiece of discussion at this year's Davos conference in Switzerland in January, the World Economic Forum, where the world's elite, business, political, and otherwise come together. This was the main topic. They devoted a whole day to it. And the argument in this book is that we're going to be facing now a double whammy as environmental disruption begins to increase and as technological unemployment begin to impact not just the class that is voting for Trump, but white collar and also the developing world. Technology and the threat of a jobless future. This has tremendous implications for society. You know, at the UN last September, Obama in his main speech talking about violent extremism out in the world, you know, rather than Islamic terrorism, right? Hillary, I think, now is calling about radical terrorism or something like that. Doesn't want to use the word Islamic because obviously terrorism goes way beyond that, and it's something that's only a small part of that religion, as I described before. But he said, we've seen ISIS taking root in areas that already are suffering from failed governance. And he said that governance is failing because of large youth populations and lack of jobs. And John Kerry's been making that basic point the whole time. That's going to be the driver of instability around the world. Societies are going to have to figure out how to give labor and meaning to their young populations, or else they will seek a different narrative. And that's, unfortunately, quite understandable. John Kerry has also said the horrific refugee situation we are facing today will pale in comparison to the mass migrations that intense droughts and sea level rise and other impacts of climate change may bring about. So, once again, in this film about Bangladesh last night, that came up. Like, at some point, we're just going to all move. We can't live here. We'll go somewhere. You know, the debate on jobs and protectionism, tariffs that we hear in the campaign today are just the tip of the iceberg here, because a lot of societies will start protecting themselves on this. Now, Martin Ford came up with a rethinking we may have to start engaging in the face of this. I mean, we can't just go back to the old 19th century tariffs idea. Or can we? Maybe that's all. Maybe not even that. Anyway, it's going to be a big, big challenge. This fifth challenge, I think, may be the most important of all. And so there we are. You know, our country can't alone solve these things. We're going to have to be working with other countries in solving these. But there we are. Anyway, it's going to be in our hands, in the hands of the generation of our students. And I think all five of these challenges can be met, but we're going to have to up our game. significantly. So thank you very much. Thank you. Good question. I get the impression, yeah, so this growth in the adherence to the Muslim faith to the point where they'll be surpassing Christianity and becoming the number one, is it because of conversion, that the religion is so attractive that it's converting more people, or is it population growth in the areas that are already Muslim? And I tend to think it's a little bit the latter, just because when you look at Africa and how fast it's growing, more African countries than we realize are Muslim. And even though Christianity has been growing in Africa quite a bit, the Muslim faith maybe is growing stronger in Africa. So I think that that's probably a large part of it. And then of course, population growth in Pakistan or some of the other... India, I don't know whether the birth rate is different among the Muslim and Hindu populations there. That's a big chunk of Muslims who are growing at a fast rate. Indonesia is also growing at a fast rate, and that's the largest Muslim country in the world. So probably it's a combination of the two leading to these statistics. The question is that I mentioned during the talk that some of the key leaders of ISIS had been in prison and had been radicalized there, had met people there, and that this seems to be a pattern you see elsewhere, including in Europe, the perpetrators of the Charlie Hebdo bombings. And so that seems to be one of the drivers of this, perhaps, also lack of jobs. And so is it true, then, that it isn't just radicalization in the mosques? In other words, that there are other factors at work here. And I think, yes, I think that there's many sources of this. It's, when we in Iraq launched the de-Ba'athification campaign I mentioned under the advice of Chalabi and the Shiite faction, we imprisoned a lot of people at all levels. It wasn't just the upper officials. We imprisoned a student like al-Baghdadi and kept them in prison for, we were pretty thorough. And so the question is, did we unnecessarily create it? That, along with the refusal of the Shiite majority to integrate the Sunnis, in fact, quite the opposite, to oppress them. And once we left Iraq, it really got bad, right? The Maliki government was really going after the Sunni political leadership. Is that one of the drivers here? And yeah, I think it's probably true that a lot of connections were made. Radicalization takes place in prison. How do you monitor prisons to prevent that? And if it's happening in Europe as well, shouldn't Europe be looking at that more? I've been to the banlieue of Paris. I was posted there, and I remember already back when I was there, some people from the foreign ministry took me out there to show me what a problem this was going to be. I mean, they saw it coming way back, because they're kind of isolated in these banlieues. They don't have a future. They in the Sunni communities from Algeria, elsewhere, the mosques are democratic institutions where a lot of this comes out. Now, this is unlike Germany. In fact, Germany is about to wake up to a new reality. Most of the Muslim immigration to Germany has been Turkish. And in the Turkish mosques, the leaders of the mosques are employed, selected and employed by the government of Turkey. They are bureaucrats of the Turkish government, which means there's a way of controlling the radicalization. And Germany and the government of Turkey work together on this, and it's well regulated. The ones coming in now from Syria, you won't have that. You're going to have real mosques now, just like you have in France and in Belgium and elsewhere. So that's going to be a change for the Germans as they see this new reality unfolding. And once again, the jobs thing, yes, that's my last point, and I agree that with Obama and Kerry, that it's a driver of the instability that's out there, and this kind of radical Islam is just one example. Well, thanks everyone for your attention. Thank you.
Tonight's program was brought to you by the Allworth Institute for International Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth and by KUMD Duluth Public Radio. This program was produced by Isaac Herman, Maya Jensen, and Cindy Christian. Tune in again 2 weeks from tonight for another Allworth International Lecture. This lecture series is recorded Wednesday evenings at UMD and is free and open to the public.